Nature's Archive Podcast, a Jumpstart Nature production.
If you were to talk to some foresters, they would term the value and the purpose of forestry solely as a means to extract resources from forests, to harvest timber, to produce wood. And then you might talk to other people who are foresters who don't think that that's our job at all. That in fact, see our job, and I'm one of these, I should say, that see our job as, yes, harvesting timber from forests. By the way, timber is a local renewable resource, and we know that we need a lot more of those. But doing so in a way that is always within the context of how do we care for these ecosystems in a holistic way, in a way that actually benefits their integrity, their resilience, their diversity, that's actually regenerative.
Forestry is incredibly interesting and important, and it really speaks to me personally because it's one of these fields that's inherently interdisciplinary. You have to understand how things relate and connect to create a healthy, sustainable system. But traditionally, forestry was all about resource extraction, which is often done at the expense of long-term sustainability. And my guest today, Ethan Tapper, is just the person to help us understand how forestry is changing. Ethan is a professional forester and has an incredibly unique personal experience, which has helped him gain a compelling perspective on what makes for a healthy forest and the trade-offs involved in getting there. Ethan personally manages a tract of forest called Bear Island in Vermont, and he's had to deal with expanses of invasive species, disease, previous mismanagement, and much, much more to turn the tides and make the forest healthier. Today, we discuss exactly how Ethan defines what a healthy forest is, the trade-offs he considers when facing challenges such as invasive species and disease, using herbicides and forest thinning and other tools at our disposal, and much, much more. And by the way, Ethan has packaged his personal journey into a book due out in September 2024 called How to Love a Forest. And you can find him on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at How to Love a Forest, all one word. So without additional delay, Ethan Tapper. Ethan, I'm really excited to have you today on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We had a brief chat, maybe what, a month or two ago, and you got me really excited about your upcoming book and your perspective on forestry in general. So I think today we're going to get into all of that. But for the uninitiated, what does forestry entail? I'm guessing it's a pretty broad definition for different activities that one may perform.
It's such a good question. And I actually, when I first got into forestry, I remember looking at a list of the majors at the University of Vermont where I had the scholarship to go. I'd been away for a couple of years and they told me when I was coming back, I had to come back within a certain period of time or I was going to lose my scholarship. So I was looking at the list of majors and I was like, forestry, well, it has the word forest in it. And that is all that I knew about it. But it's been a journey of discovery since then, because forestry is actually a lot of different things. So I would say that what forestry really is foresters are the people who navigate our relationship with forests. And that takes all different kinds of forms. But sort of the biggest bucket is within this, the role of forest management in our forests. So how we manage forests in a bunch of different ways, but often using the cutting of trees as a tool to achieve different objectives. Now, if you were to talk to some foresters, they would term the value and the purpose of forestry solely as a means to extract resources from forests, to harvest timber, to produce wood. And then you might talk to other people who are foresters who don't think that that's our job at all. That in fact, see our job, and I'm one of these, I should say, that see our job as, yes, harvesting timber from forests. By the way, timber is a local renewable resource, and we know that we need a lot more of those. But doing so in a way that is always within the context of how do we care for these ecosystems in a holistic way, in a way that actually benefits their integrity, their resilience, their diversity, that's actually regenerative. And so what we're seeing is there will always be a role for production forestry and forestry that produces these local renewable resources in the field of forestry. But then there's also many of us who really think about our role as ecosystem managers.
The question that came to my mind as you were explaining that, if you have, I know it's more complex than just a simple dichotomy, but if you have a spectrum of foresters who range from optimizing for resource extraction on one end, and then on the other end, optimizing for the sustainability and health of the forest, how much of that difference is just the time scale that the two are thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is, you know, and I think a lot of it is also the different benefits that we're considering, what we consider our job to be, right? If forestry is a means to extract timber, then our ability to do that in an efficient way on a compressed timescale is us doing a good job, right? And if forestry is our ability to just care for ecosystems generally, then timber might be part of that, but it's certainly, we're looking at it through a totally different lens, totally different array of objectives and goals, and on a totally different timescale.
So before we get much further into all the individual journeys and lessons that you've had, I do want to back up a little bit, because you said a little tantalizing piece there that you saw forestry as a major at University of Vermont, and you saw the word forest, so that kind of drew you in. Tell me how you got to that point. Like, what led you to, I guess in a way, blindly pick forestry because of that word?
I was just talking to some high school kids from my high school this morning about it. And it's fun to, like, for the book, you know, and then also in talking to people about the book, it's been fun to try to, like, trace back, like, what is my origin story? And I think that you hear a lot when you talk to folks who work in natural resources or in wildlife biology, ecology, whatever, that everybody's just like, I was the nature kid. And I was always, like, out there looking at birds or looking at bugs. And that wasn't the case for me at all. I grew up in southeastern Vermont, Windham County, in a little village called Saxons River that was maybe about 300 people. Vermont is majority forested, 75% forested. So forests were, like, always around me. And we'd go into the woods and play around and go into the woods when I was in high school and make mischief or whatever. But it wasn't like, I'm going to be a forester. What actually happened, interestingly, is that my first serious girlfriend, when I was like 18, 19, first love of my life, she, when I was in my first couple semesters at the University of Vermont, not really knowing what I wanted to do, she went on this big experience with this organization called Croca Expeditions, sort of like an outward bound type experience. She went down to Ecuador and she had this, like, transformative experience for basically 6 months. She came back and I had no way to relate to her with this new experience. And I was like, oh my God, as an 18-year-old, right? Like, my relationship's going to end because I can't understand her. And so then with 2 weeks' notice, I just signed up for the next expedition that organization was offering. Six-month expedition. I was just like, okay, we're doing this now. And which was a six-month expedition in the winter. We skied north for 2 months and then built a canoe and canoed back down, basically. So it was this full circle. Incredibly powerful, transformative experience. And after that, I ended up really just, I wanted to be in the woods and worked as a wilderness guide, apprenticed with these folks doing, like, primitive skills, primitive homestead stuff in the woods of Maine. And that brought me to University of Vermont reaching out to me and being like, hey man, you're gonna lose your scholarship if you don't come back. And I was like, oh shoot, what do I want to study? And that's sort of what led me there. So a little bit of a different route where I didn't have any idea that I was interested in doing forestry stuff until I was really an adult.
And these days, when you enter into a program like that, can you just give me a little bit of lay of the land in terms of what is taught and, like, what the curriculum looks like?
I think that it's different depending on what program you go to. At the University of Vermont, I think it's a very well-rounded sort of ecology forward program. Whereas I think there are other programs that have much more of a production component to them. So we were much more focused on how forested ecosystems function, more than we were on, like, how do we produce wood as efficiently as possible. We just don't really have production forests like they do in the southeastern United States, northwestern United States, up in northern Maine and New Brunswick, where forests are being managed in that sort of very intensive way to produce timber and other forest products. So it was much more ecology focused. But one of the things about forestry that's so interesting is that there are all these other sort of, like, subsets of these fields, right? There's, like, ecology and there's biology and there's botany and there's mycology and ornithology and all these different other mammalogy, all these different aspects that describe all of these different subsets of these different things. All of those things are part of forests, right? We're not dendrologists, right? We're foresters. And our job is ultimately to manage this incredibly complex system. So we have to know about all of those things and soil science and hydrology. And you have to have this really complex, multidisciplinary approach if you're going to be able to understand and then by extension, care for forested ecosystems. So it's a fascinating thing to study because it just sort of like explodes everything about how ecosystems work. You have to like know everything. And then what is pretty wild then is that I would argue that we're the only discipline of all of those who fundamentally are about taking action. If you want to understand what's going on in a forested ecosystem in a very like fine-tuned way, bring in an ecologist, right? If you want to do something about it, bring in a forester, because we know how to actually like affect changes in those ecosystems and are very good at doing that. So one of the, sort of my journeys has been then taking this forest ecology background and then mixing that up with other experiences that I've had that are more sort of like on the timber focus side. And then asking this question of how do we use these tools of action to then not just produce timber, I'm also very proud to be able to produce renewable resources, but to also use that to affect positive change with respect to forest ecology, biodiversity, all these other things.
So I have a really hard question, at least I think it's hard. How do you measure the health of a forest? Hey, nature enthusiast, do you want to be part of something bigger? Well, we're building a movement at Jumpstart Nature, and we've just added some new volunteers to help with our podcast and website. But this means our costs are going up too. I need to purchase software licenses to give them access to the production tools we use. For example, one media editing license costs $21 a month. And this is where you come in. Please consider supporting our mission by contributing to Jumpstart Nature through our Patreon or direct contributions, or even purchasing some logo merch. Check out all these options at jumpstartnature.com/donate, also linked in the show notes. Not ready to make a financial contribution? Then please share this episode with three friends. Sharing what we do is actually one of the very best ways you can help us. Thank you all for your continued support.
Incredibly hard. Now usually what happens when people ask me this question, we're on a walk or whatever, is that then I go on a 45-minute tangent where I just talk about everything. But more and more, the word that I use to describe forest health and healthy forests is their resilience. Resilience is something that we talk about, especially in terms of managing forests for climate change, building their climate resilience. But it's also a term that is so good at describing so many different things. I'm actually heard it used in our medical community, right? That they're like, how do we describe if a person is healthy? And it's really their resilience, right? Their ability of their body to deal with changes, right? And to be able to adapt. That's really the best way that we can describe forest health, because there are all these components about a forest that we think of as being unhealthy or like symbols of the lack of health. And some of those are true. But some of those, it turns out, are just like normal parts of forest ecology. You know, if we were to go into a forest and cut every tree that would never make a saw log, every tree that had a cavity, every tree that had internal rot, every tree that had some sort of form of canopy decline, and we were to remove all those and create a forest that was 100% perfect, like in quotes, we'd call it acceptable growing stock, healthy forest, we would be missing out on a lot of really important ecological features, right? We'd be missing out on cavity trees, which are so important to forest ecology, provide habitat for somewhere between a third to a half of all the creatures that live in this forest. We'd be missing out on the benefits of these old declining trees that inhabit this period that we call the perimortem period, the period that precedes death, this long period of death and decline that may take centuries, and that within which all of these cool habitats, complex bark structure, complex canopy structure, all of those things are realized. We'd be missing out on what happens when those trees die and fall on the ground. Deadwood on the ground, tip-ups, fallen over trees are vital features, not just to biodiversity, to stuff like invertebrates and young trees and plants and salamanders, but also to things like forest soil health and to things like forest hydrology and the ability of that forest to deal with precipitation events of increased severity and intensity and frequency. So when I talk about forest health, I'm usually talking about it in terms of resilience. And then, of course, how do we define resilience? A lot of it has been through looking at the features within forests that are going to enable them to remain healthy as a system when they're confronted with adversity. And so a lot of the things, interestingly, that confer adversity to a forest are the same qualities that we find in our old growth forests. So those are diversity, what we call risk spreading. So diversity in terms of composition, different species of trees, diversity in terms of structure, different sizes and ages of trees, what I call multi-generationality, diversity in terms of structural conditions. So that could be like having deadwood on the ground, having some big old trees. All of these things are part of how we do what's called risk spreading, not putting all of our eggs in one basket, which allow a forest to, when something happens that adversely impacts one part of a forest, that the forest as a whole can remain stable and healthy.
I really like that definition. I was thinking about some specific examples, like in a highly diverse and heterogeneous forest, how wildfire might affect it versus in a forest that is more so a tree farm with a single species densely planted, how that same wildfire, much less resilient that forest, that second forest would be to that same wildfire.
Yeah. And now I think that folks are realizing also that in the West, that when they plant a diversity of different tree species, that those are also more forest fire resilient. Yeah, I think about forest resilience as it's not like their ability to resist changes. It's their ability to accept small changes to avoid these more catastrophic changes. Mm-hmm. In the same way that we want to have forest fires of a certain type, so there are these high-frequency, low-intensity forest fires in fire-dependent ecosystems, which you don't have a lot of here in Vermont. In Vermont, we want to have some disturbances, high frequency, low intensity disturbances. But for the most part, we want to avoid these larger scale catastrophic disturbances that can be created by things like monocultures and trees that are even all the same age. An even age forest is much less resilient to that kind of thing than a multi-age forest.
Well, I imagine an even aged forest may have less resilience to, say, certain insect pests or things like that as well. If they're at an age where they have not built up their defenses, for example.
Yeah. Well, so there's examples from out west, right? Where it's like you have drought and you have different species of trees that are more or less drought tolerant and more or less susceptible to droughts. All your species are stressed at once. And then you have huge bark beetle outbreaks or these more catastrophic forest fires. Whereas if you had a species diversity or even just structural diversity, different generations of trees, they wouldn't all be reacting to that same condition in the same way that created that huge response. I know that the mountain pine beetle, right, was a native insect that sort of was driven to this outbreak status that it now inhabits permanently by these massive monoculture plantations that all got stressed at once, used to only attack stress trees, and suddenly it exploded and became like a totally different thing.
Right. Well, I think you've painted a really good picture of what resilience looks like. And it's definitely evocative to me. I've spent enough time in the forest and I've seen the effects of, say, a fallen tree and how it slowly decays over time and all the plant community that grows along that fallen tree trunk and all these different things that you're talking about, which is amazing. And I'm just going to admit, I wrote a question down based on our first discussion and I don't quite remember what it was about. So I'm hoping you do. So when we spoke previously, you mentioned that there's a false dichotomy in our relationship with forests. So I'm hoping you recall that and can tell me what you meant.
I do. Yeah, I do. And I remember it, Michael, because that's largely what I wrote this book about. So How to Love a Forest, this book that is coming out in September that I wrote. I know I'm butchering this saying, but it's like if there's a book that you would really like to read and it doesn't exist, you should go write it. So something to that effect, right? So what I was really realizing was there's a lot of books about forests are cool, right? Forests are amazing. Different aspects of forests are neat. And then very little, in my view, about what do we do about it? What does it mean to care for a forest at this moment in time? And I think that the dichotomy is like over here on one side, we have people that love forests, right? And for many of us who actively work with forests and are operating from a place of deep knowledge of forests and other ecosystems, this is a little bit more complicated. But I run into a lot in the general public, people who are like, to love a forest means to leave it alone, to protect it from ourselves, right? And that's based on, number one, we need to acknowledge the idea that the cutting of a tree, the killing of a tree could be something that's positive for forests makes no sense to most people, right? It's this incredibly nuanced thing. We need to understand all these different things about forest ecology and the role of disturbances and the history and all this stuff. So that's valid, but also it's more complicated, right? And then I think another part of it is humans just having such a bad track record of managing ecosystems that we assume that there must be nothing good that we could do, nothing that we could do that could like actually benefit them. Everything is just about degrading them. That's the only relationship that we could have with ecosystems, which is also not true. But so that's one side. People love forests, but they're like, we love them and it means that we don't do anything to them. And then on the other side is people who don't, right? And they do stuff to them. They're the ones that like cut trees, right? And they're the ones who are like killing invasive plants, and they're the ones who are like killing deer, and it's all because they don't care. So there's this, and I'm saying all these things in air quotes, right? Because this economy doesn't really exist. But the perception is that, so here are these two different ends of the spectrum, people who love forests, they don't do anything, people who don't care about forests, and they're the ones that do stuff. And what this book is really about, and what my work as a forester has really been about, is starting from the place of love. I love forests and other ecosystems deeply and intrinsically. I don't care that they give me anything. I just care about them. And then have had to ask myself, really, what does it mean to love these forests? And what I've realized is that many of the things that we would have normally thought of as being the province of the people who don't care, doing things like cutting trees, can actually be used in the right way, can actually be such more radical forms of compassion for these ecosystems when we consider all of their needs for healing, all of the ways in which we need to help them build resilience to climate change and all of these other things, all of the stuff that we've done to them, that not all of which can just be undone by leaving them alone. And so no one had written a book for me that told me what it was like to, for instance, manage my own land, Bear Island, which is a forest that's been degraded for centuries. And when I first arrived at it, I was like, there are no healthy trees here. There's a horrible invasive plant problem. There's deer overpopulation. And I had to ask myself, was I just going to say, well, nature will solve everything? Or was I going to ask myself radically, like, what can I do about it to help this ecosystem heal? I think that now that that dichotomy doesn't really exist, it's just a perception. And what we really need to do as people who talk about ecosystems and our relationship to them is to invite people who believe that that perception still exists to come have this more nuanced discussion with us and be like, let's talk about this. And I think that if we can do that, if we can bring people in, then a lot of that will go away and they'll understand this incredibly nuanced reality that we all inhabit.
There is, I think, still a little bit of this dichotomy out there for real, because I was co-leading a BioBlitz here recently, and one of the participants was very much of the opinion that it should be hands-off everywhere. So it wasn't specific to forests, but definitely there's still a little bit of work to be done. And I think that you bring up a great point where when we're talking about already highly impacted and highly modified systems that have invasive species and maybe have not had the disturbance that they normally have because of the way they've been managed, or perhaps too much disturbance, it changes all the variables. And then that, to your point, that's where it gets really difficult, because then what do you do? So let's talk about what you did at Bear Island. Tell me a little bit more about how you came to steward this property, and how big is it, and what did it look like?
So at the end of that expedition that I was talking about, I had a life-changing event happen. This is before I even started my forestry education, which is that I was working construction. I was winching these two posts together on this timber frame barn, and the rope that the come-along was attached to broke, and the come-along snapped back and hit me in the face and instantly blinded me in my left eye, which was speaking of resilience, right? Remarkably destabilizing event. And some good things came out of that. One of them was that I got an insurance settlement for a couple $100,000, and which then became what I used to buy my land, which I now call Bear Island. So Bear Island, the first time that I came to it, it was funny. Like, I was living in Burlington, which is Vermont's biggest city. It's still only 60,000 people. Only 600,000 people live in the state, by the way. Tiny. And I was sort of like looking for land with this idea that we were going to have this beautiful homestead somewhere. And this dream that I feel like a lot of people in my community have. And this piece of land had been on the market for like 2 years. You couldn't tell anything about it. All that was on the realtor's website was the picture of this clearing with this beautiful view. They were just trying to sell it as this estate lot, they would call it. And I was like, I don't see it's big. It was, they said it was 225 acres. I learned later it was 175 acres. And they had it listed for like $250,000, which for here was low. So I was like, what's wrong with it? Drove up there. Sure enough, the first thing I encountered was the entire road to get up into the property was just completely washed out. I had like the wheels of my truck straddling either side of this ravine. And then when I got up onto the log landing, which is where the road ended, there was just trash everywhere, logger pieces of equipment, busted like the door of an excavator, the track of an excavator with moss growing over it. And skidder cables and bags of trash and buried trash and hydraulic oil buckets and big deep ruts everywhere. And I was like, oh, this is not a very good start, not a very auspicious start to this. But, you know, went for a walk and it was crazy. We'd call it crazy ground, steep ground, just really, really steep, rocky, soaked in sweat the whole time, getting covered in ticks. One thing that I realized when I'd been walking for 30, 45 minutes and I stopped at this place and I still remember exactly where I stopped and I go there all the time. And I realized that there were no healthy trees there at all. I don't think I've seen a healthy tree. And what had happened is that 30 years before, this property was high graded. So it just means that loggers came through unsupervised. Basically, according to the old timers that I've talked to, I think that they told the loggers to cut every tree 10 inches in diameter and up, which is pretty small. And they just basically slicked off this whole mountain. They cut the biggest trees, the most valuable trees, which are also usually the healthiest trees, and left the smaller, less valuable, less healthy trees, essentially managing for a less healthy forest. There's some argument that doing forest management like this is actually more harmful than clear cutting, because at least if you clear cut, you're going to regenerate a new generation of trees that has a chance to be healthy. This way, you're just thinning around all the least healthy trees and not creating enough light that you're actually getting regeneration.
You're selecting for the unhealthy trees.
Which is the opposite of what you'd want. And we have these really diverse multi-species forests. Here at Bear Island, there's probably 30 species of trees. And so when you do that, you're also causing like some demographic impact. So it had created this like beech monoculture, which is a species that used to be very important to this forest, but now has this non-native pathogen and now sometimes gets in the way of us having a more diverse forest. And there's more about that in the book. I don't need to get into it. But, you know, I also found that like there was about 30 acres of the worst invasive plant infestation that I had ever seen. Japanese barberry, waist high, far as the eye can see. It was crazy. Deer evidence of deer overpopulation. I basically just like crawled my way up over these cliffs back to the truck. And I was like, screw this place. I'm going home.
I can't imagine why you would feel that way.
I was just like, this ain't it. And so I went home. And then sure enough, I just kept on thinking about it. And I actually took a course in silviculture where we were talking about restoring these degraded pine oak hemlock forest, which is what the forest type here at Bear Island is largely. And I started to think about it. I was like, geez, maybe there was something there. Went back later in the summer, and I just started finding all this cool stuff. And it really felt like there was something there that was worth saving and that was beautiful and important and vital, but that was just so beat up and so like occluded by all of the stuff that had been done to this forest that it needed help. It wasn't going to continue to exist on its own. It felt like an ecosystem on the verge of collapse, but that was still glimmering with these sparks of hope. And so ended up buying it. I bought it for like $800 an acre. Since then, that was 7 years ago, I've like really dedicated my life to caring for this forest, you know, and just cleaning up messes that I didn't cause, which is just if you manage ecosystems, you end up doing that all day long, every day. Most days is dealing with the legacies of the past and just having to not think about if it's fair or not that you're doing this. You just go and do it. And gaining skills. So I taught myself to run excavator. And every year I run the excavator for a week and close out old, unstable, eroding skid trails and build new, more resilient skid trails. I bought a skidder. It's so ironic that, of course, a skidder and a chainsaw, the same tools that were used to degrade this forest 30 years ago, are the tools that I'm now using to help it out. And I go and in areas where there's no healthy trees at all, I create openings and opportunities for new regeneration. In areas where there's some healthy trees, I cut less healthy trees that are competing with them. It's just this like has been a really cool experience to see this forest transformed. And you can actually walk through these areas now. I walk through with colleagues and they're like, oh, it's a nice forest. And I say, I swear to God, these trees weren't here before. Like, because there were so many unhealthy trees and it was just so beat up that your perception of that forest was totally different. And now I'm just like really aggressively doing what I can to give this forest the tools to be healthy again.
And you're just 7 years into this and you're already seeing this kind of difference.
Yeah. Another big thing that I have to talk about a lot that's really difficult, because I'm always worried that I'm going to get like canceled by a lot of folks. If you actually do this work and you're actually managing non-native invasive plants, so that this is what we all do, which is using herbicide. And that was like, for me, spraying herbicide on Japanese barberry after trying, I did try to control it without using herbicide. And, you know, I used herbicide and the problem is solved in a year, basically. And then with a little follow-up treatments thereafter, it's just radical when you really think about it. And I was like, man, I hear people talk about all the time, these invasive plant problems that they can't solve. And it's such a biodiversity problem. And they just sort of like throw up their hands. And I'm like, not true. You could solve those, but you're sometimes not willing to do a gross thing to allow that ecosystem to be healthy again. And I did a gross thing for 12 days, year one, and now I have spring ephemerals, wildflowers growing there, trilliums and Dutchman's breeches and spring beauties and wild ginger and all these plants that weren't there. And that's a pretty remarkable thing.
I think it's interesting. I spend a lot of time thinking about how to better communicate the fact that everything we do has a trade-off or multiple trade-offs. And it's kind of like, what are you optimizing for? What's your goal to decide whether the trade-offs are worth it? So what I hear you saying is it's not like herbicides are without negative side effect, but in this case, the limited application, the benefits far outweighed the negative side of that equation.
Here's a nuance. In the same way that I'm running Skidder and using a chainsaw, and would in no way ever say that everybody that runs a Skidder and uses a chainsaw is okay and is doing a good job. If I was king of the world, I'd probably say that the only thing you could use herbicide for was controlling non-native invasive plants. And you know, that's something that is just, when you start to really dig into some of the nuances of this stuff, it just really changes how you think about it. The analogy that I think of a lot is, if you were a parent and you had a child and the child was sick, wouldn't you just move mountains and compromise and give up anything so that your child could be healthy again, even if that meant that you had to give them a kind of medicine that you didn't feel totally comfortable with or whatever, had to in some way compromise something that you had been a belief that you'd had, or you would do it. And I don't know why we can't afford our ecosystem the same level of dignity and sacrifice and compromise. They are sick and they need help. And we have the tools to help them. That's one of the things that I've really thought about and internalized this knowledge. And I think it's important that we all know is that we are not waiting for a new invention that will allow us to solve these problems. In many cases, these solutions already exist with existing technology, with existing resources. It's just about how we use it.
So you mentioned, I think half jokingly, like you don't like to talk about the herbicide thing because you're afraid of getting canceled. But I mean, I think that's a real fear for some people when you go against what the kind of perceived notion is. And I'm wondering, you know, you talk about that we have the tools and some of them perhaps are in this category of having a negative preconceived perception. I'm trying to formulate the question, but I'm wondering how much of it is that people who care for this ecosystem, they just need to take a stronger stand in what they care for versus not being aware that these tools
exist. 100%. 100%. Yeah, because I think one thing that I've really noticed, at least where I work, again, this conversation about should we be using herbicide in some ways on controlling non-native invasive plants. In our conservation community, this conversation has already been had decades ago. And to ask ourselves, what's worse, right? These invasive plants or the herbicide? Everyone decided that the invasive plants are worse, right? And that we know that we can use it in a way that's responsible. However, there's a lot of power that comes from the partnership, right? These organizations, I'm not going to name them here, but conservation organizations that have a tremendous amount of public trust. And I talked to someone from one of them one time where actually the only old growth forest in the county that I live in, I saw dead barberry there and it was just dead. And I talked to the conservation organization that owns this forest and I said, hey, use herbicide on those Japanese barberry. And the director was like, yeah, but we didn't make a big deal about it. And I was like, well, geez, I wish you would, because if everybody's been doing it and everybody's so scared of the optics that no one talks about it. And then when I go out there and I'm just like, this is what we do. Like, this is the difference between success and failure with respect to controlling these plants is herbicide. And so I'm like, yeah, I want to talk about it. but it makes me feel like I'm standing by myself when in fact, every conservation organization is doing the exact same thing. They're just too scared to talk about it. And to a lesser extent, the same could be said for the management work we do cutting trees. Like everybody's afraid of getting canceled because they're talking about cutting trees and afraid to post a Instagram reel or whatever, where there's like a guy with a chainsaw cutting down a tree because they're going to get totally dragged by the world. When in fact, we have all, you know, we're professionals who have worked really hard to develop these incredibly nuanced solutions to these incredibly nuanced problems. And this is what we do. And if this is what we do, we should be celebrating it. And we should give the public the credit that they deserve, that they will be able to understand it and give them a lot of opportunities to understand it, really work hard to help form that nuanced understanding rather than trying to have less negative input by just not being fully honest about the stuff we're doing.
To help the public understand this, I'm hoping that you have lots of photos and have documented the transformation of your own land.
Yeah, I wish I had more. I wish I had taken more photos like year zero, but I take more and more now.
Yeah. And you're exactly right. I know from a couple of the agencies that I volunteer with that herbicide use is very common, and it's they know what they're doing with it. It's not blindly applied and year after year after year. It's for a specific case. And it does. It seems to work. I want to back up because this I found really interesting in your book and when we spoke before, but you hinted a bit before about the beech trees and how they've changed over the years and maybe are behaving even differently than perhaps they would have decades ago. So tell me a bit more about what you encountered with the beech tree stands on your property.
Beech is such a weird species. So American beech, and that's B-E-E-C-H, not B-E-A-C-H, right? Fagus grandifolia. It's a fascinating tree species because we have these pre-settlement, pre-colonial records of when they did the original surveys of the area that I live in, northwestern Vermont. We know from these records that beech was by far the most common tree in our forests. And that, in fact, our forests were somewhere between 40 and 60% beech. So it's this shade-tolerant, long-lived tree species that are in these forests where large-scale disturbances are less common, you end up with these long-lived, relatively shade-tolerant tree species. And the other species, eastern hemlock, that was the second most common tree species, very similar, very long-lived, very tolerant of shade. So American beech at that time could live to be like 400 years old, this massive hardwood forest tree that also produced beech nuts, which are this really important food for wildlife, especially black bears really have a special relationship with them. And then basically, all of our forests got cleared. I say to people, the story of our landscape here in the Northeast is that every forest you've ever been in was an agricultural field in the 1800s. And then between 1900 and like 1960 is when we saw a lot of those agricultural fields revert. And now we're 75% forested again, but our forests are pretty young.
And what do you mean by revert? Was that active management or
yes,
like a natural?
Natural. Yeah. So just fields, farm fields going fallow. And here for the last couple hundred years, when that happened, they became forests again.
Okay.
Although some of them are skewed towards species like white pine, eastern white pine, that are species that happen to have adaptations that make them good at growing in old fields, which is not really a normal adaptation. It's interesting that we have some species that are overrepresented just because they're good at growing in these old fields. So anyway, as those forests started to reestablish on our landscape, a new pathogen that we call beech bark disease, which is the combination of a fungus and a scale insect, started in Nova Scotia, I think it was like in the 20s, and started spreading southwest from there. So now beech trees are a completely different species, essentially. So instead of living to be 400 years old and become these massive smooth bark trees, I learned them as having elephant skin bark, they live to be 40 to 60 years old, 10 or 12 inches in diameter. They're all cracked and pockmarked and they're messed up looking. And then beech trees for millennia have had this adaptation where when they get stressed or when they're close to death, that they will clone themselves. So from the root system, they'll shoot up all these clones, sprouts, which allow them to essentially prolong their life almost indefinitely, right? The main trunk dies and you get these clones that take up the space and it fills the gap created by the death of itself. So the beech trees here, they get beech bark disease when they're 40. They shoot up all these clones. The predominance of those clones in the understory of our forests is made worse by the fact that deer don't like to browse young beech trees, and they really like to browse all these other species. So you can just get into a situation where you have a beech monoculture. We have diseased beech trees in the overstory, diseased beech clones in the understory, and these waves of mortality that prevent the forest from being healthy. And you get stuck in this cycle. And so that was largely going on at Bear Island when I got here, which was the loggers had gone in, cut all the biggest trees, which were largely oak and some other species like sugar maple, and beech had been in the understory or the midstory, rose into the canopy, got beech bark disease, started to die, cloned itself. Those ones rose into the canopy. They're not resistant to beech bark disease because they're clones, right? They have the same genetics, get beech bark disease, die, and around and around and around we go. So yeah, so it's just interesting. We talk about, there's a term, a great term for this, which is called cryptic function loss, which is actually something that we're experiencing with several of our tree species here in Vermont. So it's cryptic because it's secret. And the function loss is losing the functions associated with some of our native tree species. So the reason that it's cryptic or secret is because those tree species are still here. Beech is still a part of our forest. It's not going extinct. Same thing with our elm trees. Dutch elm's disease basically prevents any of our elm trees from getting to reach their historic stature, and they die when they're little. But they're still here. The species is still here. Same with our butternut trees. But the functions that were associated with those tree species when they were able to be big and hundreds of years old and massive have been lost, right? So that's why we call it cryptic function loss. And that's what's going on with beech trees. It's pretty scary when you think about the fact that our most common forest tree can no longer fulfill the vast majority of any of its historic ecological roles.
So it's not producing beech nuts anymore, I presume?
They will produce beech nuts, okay. But not a lot of them never get big enough to produce very many. Mm-hmm. And we don't even really know what ecological attributes would be afforded by a big, healthy beech tree anymore, that it just aren't there. If a forest of beech trees, 400-year-old beech trees, and it's 40 to 60% of all the trees, think about the degree to which all of the species that live in these forests would have been adapted to some part or another of the way that tree lives, from its flowers to the beech nuts to the habitats that it produces as it declines to the unique composition of its wood as it dies and falls on the ground and becomes large diameter dead wood. It's pretty wild to think about how many different functions could now be missing.
Are there any stands of refugia that have not been affected by the beech bark disease?
I'm not aware of any stands up here. So if you go further south, like I was in New Jersey and it wasn't really a big deal down there yet. And I've heard from folks in like Maryland, it's not a big deal down there. And it seems to be like pretty slow moving. But now, so backing up, there are resistant beech trees. And here at Bear Island, I love beech. I think it's an awesome species. I just want it to be healthy. So whenever I find a tree that still has pretty smooth bark, it doesn't seem like it's being affected by beech bark disease, and so it could have some genetic resistance, that's always a tree that I'll leave and try to encourage. Unfortunately, now there's another non-native pathogen called beech leaf disease that seems like it might just pretty much wipe them all out. So I don't know. It's just when we think about our mandate to care for ecosystems, it's so important that we understand all of these little stories where you start to add all these things up and you're like, how could we think that the best thing that we could do for ecosystems is nothing? How could we think that in forests that have lost or functionally lost its most important tree species that are young and simple, that have been cleared and degraded, that have non-native invasive plants and deer overpopulations, that have lost all of its apex predators and numerous other species that have been historically important to it? How could we think that, like, oh, just nature will just take care of it and like everything will be fine, and all we need to do is just not do anything and just step back and everything will be good? It's a fantasy.
Either that, or they're thinking on a timescale of millennia or something,
right,
like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and that's something that people always say. It's like the forest will be okay. And I don't even know what that means, because the forest will be okay maybe at the expense of millions of species that have evolved here and ourselves, mm-hmm, among them.
Yeah,
and that to me is not okay. So yeah, I talk a lot in my book about responsibility, and that's a big part of where that comes from for me. These things that have happened and that are happening are real. And the only question is, if we're going to decide that we're going to do something about it and we're going to try some stuff and maybe even do some stuff that makes us uncomfortable and make some sacrifices, or if we're just going to like pretend that it's enough to do nothing. And I just don't think it is.
And I think the story that you tell, you know, and we're just talking about the beech trees, but I'm sure there are many other species that have similar threats and other invasive species, and the list goes on and on. It's a story that you hear time and time again, just with different players, depending on which forested system you're in. If it's in the West, if it's in the Southeast, if it's depending on where you're at, it's the same theme with different players, I guess I would say.
Yeah. And different like layers of nuance. Like I think about my colleagues from some of the Plains states, they struggle against red cedar, another native species, which is a species that invades these historic savannas in absence of fire. Right. And so what a similar nuance to express, right? We need fire, but in the right way and not too much. And here's a species. And yes, it's a native species, but we need to cut them down and like do all this other stuff so we can get these other things. It's just like, you can really not overstate how complex these situations are. And I think if we were to be able to just message to the public, that to get them not to just accept everything that we're doing as managers, but to even just take a step back and be like, huh, I wonder why they're doing that. And to really have more of an effort to try and understand rather than jumping to conclusions like they're cutting down all these red cedar trees and trees are good and trees store carbon and like they're burning and burning's bad. And just be like, huh, I wonder why they're doing that. Yeah. I think that would be a really good outcome.
Yeah. I mean, this may be a terrible analogy, but it just came to my head. I heard a discussion of a couple people on the radio just pontificating about road construction. And they were noticing how whenever they would drive over a bridge, the material used in the road was different and it seemed to last longer and it was better. And then they get off the bridge and it's always having to be resurfaced. And the conclusion was they should make the whole road out of the concrete that's used on the bridge. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. I have never thought about that before, but there's got to be a reason. And of course, there's a lot of reasons why they don't do that, ranging from cost to the amount of time it takes for concrete to solidify and the impact it would have on traffic in the short term and blah, 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 blah.
Exactly.
And I think there are so many things where when you just have a superficial knowledge, it's easy to jump to a conclusion. So how else would you recommend that, say, the average person could help when it comes to understanding forests and ecosystems instead of jumping to a conclusion? What else can they do?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. A lot of my book is about individual action, like an individual relationship and the things that we do in our ecosystems. But then at the end, of course, in the outro or whatever we call it, epilogue, the outroduction is I talk about that ultimately, like if we can't advocate for policy that really protects ecosystems and really takes a stand against all of the things that are threatening our ecosystems and degrading them, like individual action ultimately will be meaningless, which is something I really believe. I think individual action is meaningful. What you do as a landowner on your land or as an ecosystem steward on the ecosystem that you manage is meaningful, but also must be coupled with advocacy for bigger things. Because you think about these things, like one of the examples is the carbon footprint calculator, right? It was developed by British Petroleum as a means to, instead of being like, we're all like, hey, BP, you're the problem, that we can all say, oh, we're all a little bit of the problem. And then it all falls at our feet, right? Rather than us advocating for big changes to bigger things. So it needs to be both things. And I think that in terms of like the buckets of things that we need to think about changing, and number one, obviously, is just building a collective understanding of how valuable ecosystems are to the world. And the fact that like it's being an environmentalist or whatever is a silly label, because we should all be environmentalists because we all can't exist without ecosystems, right? And we need to have laws on every scale that recognize that ecosystems are not just cool to have, but are actually vital to our lives and to our quality of life. We cannot live without them. And that biodiversity, the things that live within our ecosystems, and I would argue when I think of a forest, I'm including all of the living things that live in that forest as part of that definition, that are vital, not just, again, as a thing that's nice to have, but as an integral part of that system that makes it work. We need to have laws that protect those things. Because what we're seeing is, as much as we would like everybody to take individual action and everything to change, it's not enough. And there will always be people who don't recognize the value of those things. And they're important, not just to forest landowners, not just to people who live in these areas, but to everybody. So that's part of it. So recognizing the importance of ecosystems, and then for people who do recognize the importance of ecosystems, making some of these reforms like understanding the compromises that we have to make with respect to managing forests and other ecosystems better, doing things that are at times unpleasant or compromises like using herbicide on non-native plants, like killing deer, and especially for those of us who do kill deer, killing doe, which is, I was raised as killing doe was taboo because they have less deer. Well, surprise, we have a deer overpopulation almost across this entire continent that is having a massive negative impact on biodiversity. So making some shifts like that. And there's a million little shifts as well that depend on the ecosystem in which you're working that can actually transform these ecosystems and make them a greater asset to all of us and also to our biodiversity.
Yeah, I like your perspective on the individual action, because one of the reasons I started Jumpstart Nature was to encourage and catalyze individual action. But a quote came to mind as you were talking, and that's commonly, you know, in mathematics, you say something is necessary but not sufficient. And individual action is necessary, but it's not sufficient to solve the problems. It's the first step. It's the foundational step. So I really like that perspective. Yeah. It resonates strongly with me.
And movement building is real. We do need to build a culture of understanding of these things, but we also need to be grounded in both that the importance of that individual grassroots action and the understanding that it needs to be coupled with larger scale action as well.
So we've talked a little bit about your book and why you wrote the book. I'd like to learn a little bit more about it. So as I understand it, it comes out in
September 10.
And yep. As you were writing it, maybe you can tell me a little bit more about how the idea to write the book came to be. You said that nothing like this existed. But it yeah. seems like you started pretty early in your own personal journey into forestry.
Yeah. So the journey of how you write a book, I don't know how you do that, but I'll just tell you how I did it, which is that, yeah, I just started to get a sense that people would ask me, like, where do I go for a book written, you know, for a popular audience, not an audience of lay people potentially, or just people who aren't like forestry professionals, about the type of management that you do, them talking to me, right? And I was like, I don't know. It doesn't exist. My favorite book about forest ecosystems for a popular audience is this book called The Hidden Forest Biography of an Ecosystem by John R. Luoma, which is about a bunch of researchers, multidisciplinary crew of people in the Andrews Experimental Forest in the Pacific Northwest, who are all team up together to describe this ecosystem. But that's really just about how ecosystems work. There are other good books about how ecosystems work and some bad books about how ecosystems work. I have a little bit of a bone to pick with that book, The Hidden Life of Trees, which for anyone listening to this who actually works in forests knows is essentially a work of fiction, and all the different implications of the mythologizing and anthropomorphizing of trees that are present in that book and how it's been, I would argue, not very helpful. But so, yeah, so part of it was like reimagining forests, steering away from that hidden life of trees mythology, and just talking about forests as I talk about them all the time, which is as these systems that are dynamic and in process and complex, that are not utopias, that are imperfect and changing all the time, all these ideas that we as forest managers communicate to folks all the time. And then another part of it was then grounded in my own experience working with forests and especially working at Bear Island, trying to write a book that talks about what does it mean to love a forest at this moment in time with these degraded ecosystems and all of these threats and stressors coming down the pike and seemingly like no guidance that's out there about like, what do we actually do about it? What if we don't want to just be a bystander in this biodiversity crisis, in this climate crisis? What I started to do was really, I hacked my brain and I figured out that the time when my brain is the most creative and productive is the first hour that I'm awake, which is 5 to 6 in the morning. So I was writing a book, but I didn't really think about it as writing a book. I just wrote from 5 to 6 in the morning, every morning for 4 years.
Did you have any structure or outline in mind, or it's like just whatever you wanted to write about that day?
After about 2 or 3 years, I think I just started writing chapters about different things where I was like, I want a chapter about deer hunting. I want a chapter about when I had these loggers on my land, and just trying to have some idea for my own work as a communicator in forestry and just my time as a service forester and a consulting forester about some stuff I wanted to do, wanted to talk about generally. And then I got in touch with a publisher and got brutally taken down by the publisher, which, by the way, if you're an author, get ready for some brutal takedowns. Even if your book is good, you'll probably still get insulted personally by everybody. And this feedback that I got was correct. in my view, which is that it was too didactic and dry. And it was just basically like, here's what you do. From this feedback, I started to really try to draw apart these main ideas of the book that became the basis for the book's chapters and to reorganize. So there's these ideas of like relationship, responsibility, legacy, power, humility, change, reimagining, beauty, that are sort of like the themes of each of one of the chapters of the book. And then I also started to rewrite the book to become more, just more of a land ethic book. And it became squishier and squishier and more and more about my own experience and my own relationship with the land in a way that I think messages something really important, which is something that I realized mirrors what I try to do as a forest manager and as a communicator in my own work in Vermont, which is that it's important to me that people see how deeply I love forests and that they see, they, you know, I'm a birder. They watch me like geek out over all these birds and freak out over fungi and talk about all this, like all of these really nerdy things and to show them that I'm starting from a place of love and this is what it's about and to build trust. Honestly, so they're like, this isn't some guy who just doesn't care about trees and just wants to cut every tree down and he's in it for the money, he's in it for the timber or whatever people would say. And I want to show them that and I want there to be no doubt. And then I want to hold their hand and show them all of these really complex and unintuitive and maybe scary and jarring things that I'm doing. And to show them how those things, whether it's a cutting of a tree or a killing of a deer or spraying a herbicide on an invasive plant or whatever, are not antithetical to the way that I feel about forests. Those are expressions of love and far more radical than it would have been to not do those things. The book became a vessel for that. And I think that it was fun to watch it evolve. And now still, like when I read it, I'm like, did I write that? A lot of times just because I feel like there's some big wisdom in there that I don't know that I can fully take credit for. But that's basically what it's about. And it's meant to be meaningful, provide some information for folks in the Northeast or Eastern United States or interested in ecology generally, but then also be much more speaking to what our land ethic is and what's an evolved relationship that we can have with forests at this moment in time in the Anthropocene, in a biodiversity crisis, in a climate crisis, wherever we are.
Well, from the preview copy, I think that you hit the marks on that, and I'm looking forward to seeing the response when it's out and generally available. And I saw that you had some pretty cool folks write some blurbs, like Doug Ptolemy has a blurb about the book. Something that's always really interesting to me is communicating these challenging topics and the nuance. And it's clear to me that you're very good on the communication side, not just writing, but speaking here today. So can you tell me a little bit about some of your experiences in communicating, whether it's about your local forest or more generally, and what's worked, what's been surprising to you, any tidbits that you'd like to share?
So communication has become such an important part of my job. In my current role, I'm a service forester, which means one of my jobs is that I'm trying to improve public understanding of what healthy forests are and how we care for them. And another part of my job is that I manage these municipal forests, town forests, forests that are owned by this municipality, managed on a very small scale. And they've ended up being really great places for demonstration and education. So one thing that I realized pretty early on, and I don't think that this is, I'm talking out of school when I say this about our forestry community, is that we suck at communicating our work. And we're doing all of this really important, powerful, beautiful stuff and not communicating it effectively. And when I see foresters who care deeply about forests and are doing all this profound work about protecting biodiversity and managing for climate resilience and managing for renewable resources and managing for all these really totally amazing things and just getting dragged as if they're like some industrial forester managing trees like a field of corn, to me, that's a communication problem. And so what I often say is most people are in favor of forest management, supporters of forest management. They just don't know it yet. And the reason they don't know it is because we haven't told them it in a way that resonates with them. So I did some forest management projects on these community forests that I manage. One of my favorites is this place called the Hinesburg Town Forest, which is a 1,125 acre town forest in the town of Hinesburg, Vermont. And one of the things I wanted to really lean into was this idea of doing this open and transparent and inclusive outreach process. And recognizing, as I think we all should, that this work is unintuitive and that we need to give people the tools to understand the work that we're doing. So I tried to make my presence in that town forest. Unavoidable would be the word that I would use. So basically to completely saturate the community with information about this project and opportunities to learn more. That took the form of walks and talks and YouTube videos on my YouTube channel and articles in the community newspaper and all different cultural events in the community, all different kinds of things with the thought that if we're reaching out in different ways, we will reach different people. We're not trying to do some symbolic level of public outreach where we're like, oh, well, we did enough and people had a chance. Even if no one attended, people had a chance. I'm like, I'm coming at you as hard as I can, wherever you are. And if you don't want to go on a walk on a, 1 p.m. on a Saturday in the winter on an active forest management project, maybe you read the local paper. Maybe you watch YouTube. Maybe you watch the local television station when I'm on there being interviewed about it. Maybe you'll check out some other thing, some other resource that I put together, and really trying to approach it that way. And I thought that that was really powerful, number one, because I believe in this work and I believe that the work that we're doing is really important. And reaching people and messaging that is vital. And then also because it messages that this is not something that we're ashamed of. This is something we're proud of. And we actually want people to learn about it. I also really got into exploring partnership because maybe you think that me as a forester, as the Chittenden County Forester for the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation, and I'm just some timber guy and all foresters, they don't care about forests. They just want to cut trees or whatever. It's much harder to marginalize me and the things that I'm saying if I'm also partnered with other organizations that you trust. So I'm an Audubon-endorsed forester, and I do all these events with Audubon about how the work I'm doing is providing excellent habitat for neotropical songbirds and also our year-round birds, and is just doing all these amazing things for bird habitat. I do events with the Vermont Land Trust, where we talk about the importance of managing our ecosystems for conservation and how we protect intact and resilient ecosystems. I do events about carbon and climate change with the University of Vermont and some of these really well-respected scientists, researchers, professors that they have on their staff as well. And that you reach different people and you lend credibility to the work that you're doing because you're showing that it's not just us, it's all of us, right? It's all of these different organizations that are arriving at these same complex and nuanced actions together. I also got into, and I got really interested in being like, who else are we aligned with? So I just started asking people if they wanted to go on a walk. And at my local co-op, I was like, you guys do like cooking classes. How'd you like to go out on active logging job and talk about it? And sure enough, you get all these people who are maybe not constituents of mine, but are constituents of the co-op and come out and we talk about the nuances of the project. And at the end of the walk, everybody feels great. I reached out to, there's a series called Pride Hikes that are largely done by these organizations, Outright Vermont and Pride Center of Vermont, which are LGBTQ advocacy organizations. And was like, hey, want to go on a walk? And in every case, reaching out to all these different sort of non-traditional partners, these people have never been asked to be part of our coalition. We've just assumed that it's good enough that we reach out to people who already agree with us. Whereas what we really should be doing is trying to cast as broad a net as possible as we try to message our work. That was transformative for me. And I think it's something that we all need to lean into as a community.
I think that's a great recommendation. Definitely need to figure out how to reach more people, broader sets of people, people maybe who haven't realized this connection yet. So are there any other books or documentaries or people to follow on social media or whatever the case might be that you would recommend that we follow to learn a little bit more about forestry and the sorts of things that you like to deal with?
Yeah, all of Doug Tallamy's work is really good. So Doug Tallamy is an author, focuses a lot on like smaller scale conservation. He wrote some books that I really like. Again, that book, The Hidden Forest, Autobiography of an Ecosystem by John Luoma is a really special one. Oh, there's a whole bunch of books that I really like. I mean, my favorite nature author ever, by the way, is this guy, Sigurd Olsen, who is a nature author. My favorite book of his is called Runes of the North, and that's from the 60s. And then, of course, for land ethic books, Robin Wall Kimmerer, Braiding Sweetgrass. In many ways, I think the success of Braiding Sweetgrass paved the way to allow me to be able to get a publisher for my book because demonstrated that there is public appeal toward writing a book about just having a land ethic and a relationship with ecosystems. My guy, Griff Griffith, at Redwoods Rising. I've been at Griff on TikTok mostly. I got to spend some time with Griff out in the Redwoods. That was pretty cool. I also really like the work of, I'm going to butcher his name, Kyle LaBarger. He's at the Native Habitat Project on most platforms. He is great. And he has a very active following. Yeah, and there's a variety of other creators that I like. At Plants Are People too. That's Tom Groves. He's from here in Vermont. It's been fun. I've been really engaging with and mobilizing my social media presence. I'm on YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram as at How to Love a Forest. And then also on Facebook. And so I've got to connect with these other creators. It's been fun because some of them I'm like, hey, let me send you my book. And if you like it, you can write something about it on your page or whatever. And there's a community of people who are doing great work and are lifting each other up and really providing a lot of great resources. Yeah.
Those sound like great starting points. So you just mentioned your social media, and you know, for everything that you mentioned, I'll make sure those are in the show notes as always. But I do want to ask you, obviously your book is a huge project, but do you have any other projects, anything else in the works that you'd like to highlight at this point?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So How to Love a Forest, it's out in September, but you can pre-order it now. And if you do want to pre-order it, pre-ordering it is helpful to me, but you won't get it until September, unfortunately. But yes, follow me on these social media feeds, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. I'm also, as of May 31st, I'm leaving my job with the state of Vermont, and I'm starting my own forestry business called Bear Island Forestry. I'll offer consulting forestry services to folks more local to me in Northwest Vermont, but also general consulting services. So something I'm really interested in is working with NGOs and nonprofits and other organizations and advising them on communication around ecosystem management, because that's something that I've really specialized in my work as a service forester, and also doing some more writing, some more freelancing, and working, seeing if I can use this book as a platform to affect greater positive change in the world. So I'll be basically available through Bear Island Forestry, bearislandforestry.com, and at ethantapper.com. You can see the other services that I'm offering, including this more general consulting, trainings, mentorship, and other opportunities.
That all sounds great. All right. Well, this has been really enlightening and a lot of fun to hear your perspective and just speak to someone with kind of a similar perspective as well. So before we adjourn for today, is there anything else that you've been wanting and just needing to get out on the airwaves before we hang up?
Sure. I mean, I guess one of the endorsers of my book called my book A Manifesto Against Apathy, right? I think that one of the things that I would just want to, you know, say out there, and I know that there are people out there who feel the same way, is that when we see these things happening to ecosystems and to each other by extension of species that are reliant on ecosystems, we don't have to be bystanders in all of these things. We can be actors. We have the tools. We have the resources today to do these things. And the only question is if we will do those things. And so I guess I'm just reaching out. If you feel that way, if you're a person who's like me, who believes in our ability to be a keystone species in our ecosystem, you're not alone. And let's get together. And let's affect some change in the world.
Awesome. Can't think of a better way to end. So thank you once again for all the time that you spent today and for creating this wonderful book. I really appreciate you. And I guess I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you.
And one more note. Thanks again to Kat Hill for editing help with this episode. Thanks for sticking through the entire episode. If you made it this far, I hope that it means that you enjoyed it. If so, please spread the word and share this episode with three friends or groups that you think would enjoy it too. As for today's episode, let me know. Did I miss anything? Was there a topic I should have covered? Let me know at podcast@jumpstartnature.com or DM me on any of my social accounts. I'll do my best to answer your questions. You can find me at Nature's Archive, one word, on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I also share photography, nature stories, and much more on those accounts, so you can follow just to stay in touch too. And despite being called crazy by numerous friends and colleagues, last year I left my tech career behind to start Jumpstart Nature, which Nature's Archive is now part of. For the sake of myself, my family, and the planet, I need to make this work. So please also consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/jumpstartnature. I offer some exclusive content and perks, and you can start donations as low as $4 a month. Lastly, please also check out our latest creation. It's the Jumpstart Nature podcast. We just completed our pilot season, where each episode reveals an unseen, surprising, or misunderstood nature topic with the help of experts and our host, Griff Griffith. It's entertaining and inspiring, and even reached number 3 on the Apple Nature podcast charts. There's much more on our roadmap, but we need your support. So check out jumpstartnature.com for more details. Thank you.